It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rabbit Talk Radio. Carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and the list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com. www.johnmack13.com. At the same site are links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, and links to my series of newspaper columns. Upcoming episodes of this show will include authors, poets, editors, judges, technologists, pundits, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope you will too. By occasional 15-minute story opinion shows, John Mack's Radio Rant, I may also be accessed by going to my website, once again, www.johnmack13.com, and clicking the John Mack Radio Rants tab for the next shows. That show is broadcast on, as I mentioned, on an occasional basis, as the spirit moves me. My guest next week on this show is writer and media personality Kate Kelly. Tune in and listen. Tonight marks my 52nd show in this radio series, the end of a year, speaking to very interesting people, college presidents, ex-lieutenant governor, columnists, poets, novelists, including science fiction writers, editors, technologists, law enforcement officers, a judge, an architect, a radio TV host, state and federal prosecutors, religious leaders, in short, people whom I find interesting. And it's been a great year. I've had both great conversations and learned a lot. Ironically, two of the conversations that I've enjoyed the most were with people that I've known most of my life. And that's not most of my adult life. It's just most of my life, period. And it's not that I lost track of these people over the years. One I see a few times a week, and one I speak to regularly on the phone. So therefore, it makes sense to me that my guest tonight on the last show of my first year is one of my oldest friends, Thomas Todd Roach. Todd, never Tom or Tommy, grew up around the corner from me in the Inwood section of Manhattan, New York City. Inwood is the northernmost neighbor on Manhattan Island, and it's surrounded on the east end and north by the Harlem River, and on the west side by the mighty Hudson River. When Todd and I grew up, it was an Irish Catholic Jewish neighborhood. Todd and I had some Protestant and Italian Catholic friends, but they're in the side of the minority. The neighborhood is best known for the wonderful Inwood Hill Park, which contains the only forest in New York City and is the area that Peter Menuet supposedly purchased from Manhattan Island from the Indians. While we all consider Inwood Park our park, it was literally Todd's backyard, as his apartment house, 583 West 15th Street, was just across the small street from the park. Todd was the year behind me in Good Shepherd Grammar School and to Dwell House High School, and then got past merged as I went to Iona College and Todd went to Manhattan to study engineering. Since then, Todd has lived all over the United States and in Europe in his 40-year engineering career and his over 10-year retirement. We'll explore this life, both inward and beyond, tonight on the John Mack Radio Show. Good evening, Todd, and welcome to the show.
Good evening, John. This is both a fascinating and interesting opportunity for me. I've never been on the radio before, and it's interesting to ultimately find out what it sounds like. But I'm just thrilled to talk about the old days at Inwood.
So let's start at the beginning. Where did the nickname Todd come from?
Well, that's a funny story, I think. The way my mother explained it to me, my birthday is the 18th of March. So I was in an Irish, you said, in an Irish Catholic neighborhood. I was between St. Patrick and St. Joseph. So I became Thomas because that was what they decided. They had picked, for some reason, Todd as a name. And at that time, the priests were reluctant to baptize you with even a first or second name that wasn't a saint's name. So they couldn't get Todd in officially. So I was Thomas officially, but I've been Todd ever since one of my father's friends came to visit my mother and me in the bassinet in the hospital and said, "Oh, little Todd." And the story my mother tells, and I've never been able to authenticate this story, including asking people in Ireland. This gentleman claimed that was Gaelic for little Thomas, and that's the story that I was told.
All of the Todds that I've known or heard of spelled the T-O-D-D, your single D Todd, the only one I've ever heard of. Have you ever met another?
I probably have met others, but you're right. Certainly the dominant spelling is with two D's. In fact, we're currently involved in building a home here in North Carolina, and the salesman that we dealt with at the building company is a Todd with two D's. And we had quite a bit of banter back and forth about who had the right name.
Speaking of names, I have not forgotten the image of your parents being introduced to someone, that's Connie and Joe Roach, and folks reaching out to shake your father's hand with, "Hey, hello, Joe," and having to be corrected as Joe with Josephine, your mother.
That's exactly right. And actually, many people thought that she was Josephine. She was actually Johanna. And her her maiden name was Schmidt. So in English, my mother was Jo Smith.
I remember. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, I was.
I remember your mother being a strong taskmaster when it came to education and being very concerned with both your and your sister Patricia's grade. Although she had little to be concerned with either of you, I think I remember you, after having probably the lowest grade of your life in an algebra test in Ohio, as being apprehensive about what your mother's reaction would be. Does that ring a bell?
I was properly apprehensive. Yes. Well, actually, the worst of it is one time in elementary school, I got a 66 on a test, and I barely survived that. You're right, but my sister is quite a bit better student than I am, or was. I got by on a lot of native intelligence. I was not nearly the student my sister was, in terms of application and working at.
Well, we were just talking the other day. I had lunch at the a monthly Inwood luncheon, and Richie Chinnick was up from Washington, and he was talking about how many very smart people there were in his class. You and Pat Maher and Bobby Schneider were some of the names. Oh, and that came to mind.
There were probably dozens. I mean, when you look at the successes that came out of Good Shepherd School, I think the list would be many, many pages, not only in our class or your class or my class, but long before us and long after us. You said my mother was a stern taskmaster, and fortunately so were the teachers in Good Shepherd.
Richie told a funny story. He was on some trip, some State Department trip, and someone said that he's got something in common, the Catholic school background, with this columnist at the Washington Post company with him named Tom something or other. And so he went to talk to the fellow, and he said, "Where'd you grow up?" And the fellow said, "New York City." And he said, "Oh, where'd you go to school?" And he said, "Well, I graduated from Good Shepherd." He said, "Well, I don't remember you. What class were you in?" He said, "Well, my teachers were Brother Matthew when I transferred into the school, and Brother Michael." So Richie said, "That's my class." He said, "How is it that I don't know you?" And he said, "Well, I was rather quiet, and you have to remember, there were 53 kids in our class."
Right. Yeah, you know, that was funny. One of the first things that that came back to me about Inwood when we moved to Virginia, we had been living in Texas before that, was you folks up in Inwood had that reception for Brother Michael's birthday. I forget, was it 70?
Yes, we had a dinner for him. Terry Chigrou, Jack Walsh, and I put it together because we had been down to visit him in Lincraft, and it was terrific. It was just like we're all still in the class, you know. We gave him a watch.
But that was his 70th or 75th birthday.
He had started teaching. I was in his first class before you had him, and he had started teaching. And I believe he's probably in his late 70s now. He was teaching just out of school. He had his bachelor's, and I was the first class, and you were the second.
Well, and that's what I worked back to when, and I think it was his 70th birthday that you folks had that dinner for him. And I worked back from that because we were about 12, I think. I had him first in the seventh grade, and then very fortunately, he continued, and he took the same class into the eighth grade. So I had him for 2 years. So that meant that, you know, I had him his second year teaching. If you had asked me, I would have said, oh, he was 40 or 45 years old. And he was probably about 23 or 24.
No, you had him his third year teaching because I had him for 2 years too. I had him the sixth and the seventh, and then you had him in the seventh and the eighth.
Seventh and eighth, yeah. And he was unbelievably young. And it's funny, when you're young, 12 as we were, people's ages were meaningless. You know, it was very, very difficult to really understand how old people who were older than us were, at least for me. I've never been very good at judging people's age. And I was hopeless then. I would have sworn he was 40 years old or, you know, something like that. I thought he was one of the oldest brothers, actually.
But he was athletic. He'd take us out to play basketball or to go on bike hikes or to have the snowball fights.
Oh, the bike hikes were fabulous.
Yeah. Yeah. We played baseball and basketball together for a number of years, with you by far the much better baseball player, going into my Mel Allen voice. I'm going into my Mel Allen voice. You can't interrupt me. And now here's the pitch from St. Elizabeth's Doug Cummings. Roach swings, and wow, that ball is going, gone. That must be the longest ball ever hit into right field on Inwood's diamond number one. The right field is still chasing across the path and against the tree as Roach wounds the bases. Do you remember that shot? Was it the longest ball you ever hit?
Oh, absolutely. I think I'm not bragging because I'm being realistic. I think it was one of the longest balls I ever saw anybody hit in that park. I don't know how I hit it that far. It must have been rabbit ball.
The only balls that I remember being hit that far and that hard when we played ball were by a lady, Queen of Martyrs, Bill Bolger, off our mutual friend Bob Cummings. Now, Bill was right-handed, so he put it out around the softball field. If you remember, Bob was an outstanding pitcher for us, but couldn't pitch to Bolger. Bolger was a fine athlete.
I played center field. I had to chase those.
Yeah,
and some of them took. I remember one of them that he hit out there that was hit so far, or rolled, you know, hit and rolled. And one of the people watching the softball game picked it up and threw it back to me, and he was long home before I even got the ball back to the infield.
Yeah, I never saw anything like that because Bob was a good pitcher, but he couldn't pitch to Bolger. Bolger put it over the fence and into the river at George Washington Field, and then it was moonshot. Why do you think that was, that he just couldn't pitch to him?
Well, I don't know, and it may just have been the right-handed left-handed. Bolger was a right-handed hitter, and it may just been right in his alley.
Yeah, well, he pitched to other righties.
Yeah, but Bolger was one of the best hitters we played against.
Yeah, he played for Iona. Did you Did you play for Manhattan?
Just as a freshman.
Okay. Did you ever play against him? Against Iona?
No, we didn't play Iona. We had my freshman schedule at Manhattan suffered from the typical northeastern weather. We had probably a 20 or 24 game schedule, and we probably played 12 games because of rain.
Unlike your son, who played forever when he played college ball, right?
Yes. Well, he played in Washington D.C., so they had the same problem. But they would go to Florida in March, and play for a couple of weeks in Florida, and then by the time they came back, it was a little bit more tolerable. But
in his age also play a split schedule though, which they didn't. We were there both the spring and the fall.
They played split schedule. I don't know that the fall schedule was competitive. I think they played about 10 games that were as much scrimmages as they were games. There were no league competitions or anything. But they were permitted practice and play. So he was in a Division III school, so they weren't in a at that time they weren't even in a conference. They later joined one of the small conferences in the D.C. metropolitan area, which included Maryland, Pennsylvania, quite a distance. They would have to travel quite a ways to play sometimes.
Then how did he get the notoriety to be asked to go to Australia? How did he get that kind of coverage?
He was a Division III All-American.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, holds some. No, he was a center fielder.
Oh, okay.
And a tremendous hitter. He still holds many of the hitting records at Catholic University.
Oh, okay. Inwood was, I mentioned earlier, an Irish Catholic Jewish neighborhood. It was also known in those days as having more bars than any neighborhood in New York. Walter Winchell referred to it as Ginwood in his columns. And we, me much more than you, upheld the drinking tradition of the neighborhood during our teen years. Richie Shinnick, who was speaking to us last week, he's the recent high-ranking official above the State Department and Homeland Security. He was saying after the luncheon that he felt that the culture in which he grew up, the strong attachment to the Catholic Church with so many of our friends with interreligious orders, even with a cup of coffee, of the sports, the drinking, the long-term friendships was unique. Does that feeling ring true to you?
Well, you know, there are so many things about Inwood that are different from today's world, or at least where I live. And as you mentioned, it was, first of all, it was a fairly large neighborhood and from, say, 200th Street to 220th Street with apartment buildings. So there were a number of thousands of people that lived in what was the equivalent of a small town physically, but population-wise, it wasn't a small town. And most of those people, as you mentioned, were ethnically and culturally aligned. The Catholics all went to the same grammar school, and their siblings all went to the same grammar school. So we knew by name probably hundreds of other people, other families. You know, we may not have known John Smith, but, oh, yeah, John's sister was in my sister's class. So I know who they are. They had a legitimacy, if you will. And I think that is very good for harmony. I mean, people were together. There was little discord. You know, crime was somewhat unknown. So I think that's true. And drinking was more, for at least when we were young, drinking was a purely social activity. You know, it wasn't an obsession with us, so to speak. We may have spent a fair bit of our spare time dabbling at it on weekends or whatever. And I think that was, you know, important. And as you mentioned, Inwood Park. Inwood Park was such a phenomenal sports venue for everybody who lived in Inwood. So, yeah, I think all of things come out of it. I think that if we had been in a different time, in a different place, we wouldn't have had as coordinated a life, if you will. So yeah, I think that's very true. I think that the fact that there were a lot of bars there were also a lot of people. So, you know, I mean, those bars were busy, but they weren't overburdened like you see in some other places. Like where I've lived, like particularly near Washington D.C. on Thursday and Friday nights, if you go to what's now known as a sports, you basically can't get in the sport. There are hundreds of people in there. In the bars in Inwood, there were dozens or tens of people in small little groups, spending more time talking than drinking, I think.
Yeah, other than Chambers, where there was always these lines in the street. But the there was also a less pressure than there was on the youth that came later. There was no drugs. We heard about about drugs, but we were told that anyone that to use them was a dope fiend or a musician. And there was no sex. It was pre-pill, and the girls most of us knew were Irish Catholic girls who thought if you opened the blouse they were either going right to hell or get pregnant or both at the same time. So we played a lot of sports and we drank. And I agree. It was the social aspect, hanging around talking and everything.
Just think of how many Fridays and Saturday nights you and I and other people spent in Inwood Park spending 3 hours with a six-pack. And it was all social.
Yeah, or Mike with an 18-pack. But, yes, it was definitely just sitting around talking. Shortly after 9/11, there was a Twilight Parade through Inwood led by Father Kevin Devine. Jim Casey and I carried the flags, and Richie and Betty Scalato led the singing. At the conclusion of the parade, we assembled in the church. There must have been 1,100 people. It was totally packed. At the conclusion, and one of the speakers, Assemblyman Stanley Michaels, the only Jewish member of the Good Shepherd Men's Club, said that no matter what your faith, Good Shepherd has always been the center of the neighborhood. And that made me remember that our Protestant and Jewish friends, like Hobart and John Fitterman and Bob Scott, played in the Paris Sunday of New Basketball Leagues, and they went to our Friday night dances. From what I understand, other Catholic parishes weren't as open to people as of other beliefs. Do you remember anything like that?
Well, I don't remember the other parishes because I have no experience, but I certainly agree with you. Anti-Semitism was not in our vocabulary.
Yeah.
And you're right. Most of us all had one or more Jewish friends of either sex that we knew, and we may not have had familial associations with them, but we had no difficulty with them. If we met them, we associated with them, and it was all fine. And I think you're right. The lack of drugs and the lack of a black side of life, if you will, made things much smoother.
One last thing on the neighborhood. As you probably remember, each of us in the original very close group from 215th Street and from Seaman Avenue, to which we grew up, went to college, and many of them even wound up with advanced degrees. I remember one person, even though he had left the faith to which he grew up, contributed his love of knowledge to the rigor imposed by the Christian Brothers. You and I were taught by both the De La Salle Christian Brothers and the Edmund Bryce Christian Brothers. Comment, if you will, on the impact that they had on your life, both positive and negative, if any.
Well, I can only comment positively. I mean, there may have been some individuals that I thought may have had a little too much discipline to keep us in line, but that discipline was all directed towards making sure that we got an education. And I think they were terrific. I really enjoyed the Irish Christian Brothers at All Hallows. I thought that they allowed us to develop maturity. They treated us as grown-ups, and I was very comfortable with it. Now, I had the De La Salle Christian Brothers in college, but to a very small extent, because there just weren't that many of them in the engineering school. The ones that I had were also fantastic. So my hat is tipped to both of those orders for the way they provided me with educational opportunities. And, of course, we can't forget the nuns, although I only had nuns in the first and second grade. But they certainly got us all started on the right track. And when I say all of us, and back to this point, I said that there were a lot of successes in England. One of the things that, to Brother Michael's credit, was when we were in the eighth grade, his class, our class, was given a day off because we were the first eighth grade class to get 100% acceptance at a Catholic high school. And I think that goes, and those are competitive exams to a certain extent. They weren't all as competitive as Regis or Bronx High School of Science or something. But, you know, that was a credit to the first 7 years plus Brother Michael in the eighth grade. So I have nothing.
Yeah, my two favorites in those years were obviously Brother Michael in grammar school and Brother Bradley at All Hallows. Talking about all acceptance to a Catholic school, Brother Clement used to beat it into everyone's head that if you don't do well, you're going to have to go to Mount St. George. He really made George Washington sound like the end of the earth, which it really wasn't, but that was the line.
Well, and I think my parents took very much the same attitude. Yeah, that's right. The public schools were not held in high regard by Good Shepherd parents. At least I never heard any that were, although it's interesting. There were several people who lived in 583 who were graduates and very successful people who were, you know, earlier day graduates of George Washington High School. And again, you know, back to your point about the lack of crime and the lack of drugs, regardless of what anybody may have thought about George Washington High School, it was not a problem school.
Yeah, well, everyone points out is Roberta McHale, who went there, points out that Bernard Baruch went there and many other, Henry Kissinger and many other well-known people. It was interesting because All Hallows had the same push toward non-Catholic colleges. One of the brightest guys in my class was Ed Hine, who was accepted to Princeton, and they gave him such a hard time, didn't want to write his references. They told me he was going to lose his faith. John Valentine went to Manhattan Prep, and he was going to City College, and they didn't want him to at Manhattan Prep. They offered him half a scholarship to a college for swimming. He turned that down. They offered him a full scholarship, and they couldn't understand why he was going to go. In those days, they really made it difficult. Now, if you get the letters from All Hallows, they take pride in how many of their graduates are accepted into Ivy League colleges. So, times have changed.
Yeah, and actually, I worked with a couple of people at Mobile, and City College is actually quite a fine institution.
Yeah. Dennis Sullivan was an engineer out of City College. I was going to get into that with engineering. As I mentioned earlier, you went on to Manhattan College to study engineering after All Hallows. What attracted you to engineering?
Well, it's interesting because what attracted me to it never became my career. In 215th Street, my next apartment neighbor, Penny Sheehan's family, if you remember, Penny's grandfather, John Cregan was their name. He was an engineer, and he was a civil engineer, and he spent most of his life traveling and working around the world. And I thought, gee, that's great. I could become an engineer and work outdoors. So I signed up at Manhattan College in the civil engineering program. But thanks to Brother Carr at All Hallows, I had fallen in love with chemistry. He was our chemistry teacher, and he just made it exciting and interesting for me. And about halfway through my freshman year at Manhattan, they introduced the chemical engineering program to begin the following year at the sophomore level. And about myself and about five other engineers and five or so chemists from the arts and science school came together and joined up into the chemical engineering class. And there were 11 of us in the class, and we were actually quite a close-knit group. It was small, and we were pretty close together. We did a lot of lab work, so we spent a lot of time together as a group. So two things. One, first, the idea of working outside, and second, my interest in chemistry is what got me interested first in engineering and then ultimately in chemical engineering. And I, in my career, I never wound up doing a lot of detailed chemical engineering. I've always been a very practical, nuts and bolts kind of guy. And I got into some very practical aspects of engineering where I had some applied chemical engineering, but then I got into cost estimating and something that we call cost engineering, and I wound up spending most of my career, early career, in doing project management work, being on a couple of building projects, and then working back in the home office and leading a part of the chemical and the cost engineering group where we were doing the budgeting. So I was always involved with the dollars and cents of engineering. Quite interesting.
I remember that you were in the first class of chemical engineering at Manhattan. Three of the things that you said bring up interesting things. You mentioned Penny. I've seen Penny probably over the last 5 years, although not for the last two. She's a widow and she lives in Connecticut. She was active in the schools, but her husband apparently had been sick for a long time. Her cousin, who I knew better, Bobby Frank, passed away, as did her cousin who lived in Dan Sheehan's house, Jackie Sullivan. If you remember, they're all connected to that family.
That's right.
Brother Carr is in the retirement home for sick people, I guess. It's near Iona. It's not owned by the college. And it's this very nice house, but he and Brother Kelly, they're in there. And Brother Kelly's eyes dance back and forth. And if you talk to him, I've talked to him when I was up to see my friend Brother Walsh. He apparently understands what you say, but he doesn't talk. And Brother Carr apparently has some speech problem, and he's got some. At that time, they thought he had Alzheimer's. That's very sad. Remember how tough Kelly was. It was just it's sad to see him like that. I went to see Kelly, and I go ahead.
Neither one of them was a pussycat.
No. Carr, you could tell. If Carr came in and threw his bag up on the platform, everything was fine. You could kid around a bit. If he walked in slowly and put his bag down, it was time to be quiet in the class.
I told you he turned me on to chemistry, and I will never forget. And I tell people this: we didn't, Ohio was a pretty basic school. We had a gym of sorts; it was pretty tiny. We had no outside sports fields. We had no chemistry lab, so we never did any hands-on work. All of the chemistry experiments that are part of the curriculum, Brother Carr did in the front of the room with explanation, etc. And one of the ones he did was to demonstrate that hydrogen was explosive, but not combustible. And what he did was he did one of the experiments, mixing various chemicals to produce some hydrogen, which he then trapped in a champagne bottle. And then he wrapped the champagne bottle in a heavy rubber lab apron, held it under his arm, and put a flame in front of the bottle, and it blew up in the front of the classroom. The bottle didn't blow up. The gas exploded, at the mouth of the bottle. And I thought, that's pretty unique.
Well, we had a lab, and a chemistry lab, and he had us down to it. I burned my hands on the deframed to the Bunsen burner. But one thing we did, and we weren't there much, maybe it was once or twice, we distilled alcohol. And then he asked for the volunteer, and Freddie shouted, drank it. So, that's my only memory there. I spoke to him a number of years ago. I called Jackie Wolfe, the female who you may remember from the Good Shepherd Dances, and then he was at her house. He was the golf friend of her husband's. Then I said, put him on the phone, so don't tell him who I am. So he gets on the phone, and I said, you slid into my brother in a baseball game, and you put him in a hospital at West Penn. He said, John McMullen, how are you? he was an interesting guy. I asked the question about engineering because very few of us had an opportunity to put our education into specifics of employment the way that you did. I was an English major who later who first went to work for an insurance company and then spent the last 50 years of a technologist, none of which directly related to Chaucer, go to Hemingway. Shortly after graduation, you joined M.W. Kellogg, where you would have spent it for 7 years of your 40-year engineering career. What was it like putting your education into practice?
Well, first of all, it was a good-paying job, which was not one of the smaller reasons for wanting to become an engineer. But, it was a fantastic way. I really enjoyed my time at M.W. Kellogg. M.W. Kellogg has had a lot of press over the last 20 years, not all of it favorable. And when I was with M.W. Kellogg, their field of view was much narrower than it is today. They didn't do managing contracts for the government. We were basically a chemical plant, or almost exclusively a chemical plant and oil refinery designer and constructor. And we were unique in some respects that we had the full capability to design as well as construct. Many of the other large contractors were only constructors, and someone had to bring a design to them, where a client could come to us and say, we would like to build a refinery in West Texas to produce this much, to handle this much crude oil, you know, every day, and this is the kind of crude oil it is, how much will it cost us? And we could do the whole thing, from the design to the cost estimating to the building. And the people that I met that were capable of doing that were just fascinating people. There were no egos. It wasn't like maybe a sports or a media type business where there was some competition among the people, so therefore people were more career sensitive. But at Kellogg, it was very much a team-oriented situation because everybody had their own job to do. And your job kind of fit into a matrix, and when all that matrix came together, you got a good project, being something that made profit and was finished on time. And that was very important to somebody who had never worked outside of a supermarket before, where you just took orders and put your head down and followed orders. And at Kellogg, it was very interesting to work with people who had been doing it for a long time, first of all. So they knew all the ins and outs of the business. And then we had clients. And occasionally you would meet with a client, which was another whole experience. As a guy right out of school to stand up in front of a client and say, well, this is why we're going to do this. And, you know, convince them that that was the best way to do it. So it was certainly challenging, first of all. And it was so diversified from anything else that I'd ever do. Like many people who go to a technical education, and they come out and get into the business world and expect to do exactly what they were taught in school, and it doesn't work that way. And that was also extremely eye-opening and interesting. That what I was going to do on an everyday basis was not really an extension of what I had learned in school. What I had learned in school may have been somewhat of the foundation of it, but it was all new from day one at work. And it was very interesting.
And what you learned
in
school.
It was a worldwide company.
And what you learned in school also got you the job. And at that time, you mentioned the salaries were good. Such
exactly.
Tremendous demand for engineers because of the space race. And there wasn't just working for the government. There was so many contractors and people providing things to them. And I knew so many folks who wanted to be engineers, but from your class, the only ones I remember really making it were Dennis O'Sullivan, who's the civil engineer, and Bill Fitzgerald, who I'm not sure what kind of engineer he is, but he's the chief operating officer at the Botanical Gardens in the Bronx.
I think, then he might have been a mechanical engineer. I'm not sure. I don't remember what kind of an engineer Bill was. Yeah.
Okay. He was our catcher, too, and a damn good one, right?
That's right. And his father was the coach. And his father was the coach for a long time before that. I don't know about after that.
Yeah, well, it's when McArdle came back full time, then he became the full coach, and the two Pats, Cregan and Fitzgerald, they were the bench coaches, if you remember.
Right, right. But Pat had been McArdle's coach.
Yeah. If you remember, he came to the reunion we had 30 years ago at Lake Osceola, the Pat Fitzgerald. He and Father White were the oldest guys there then. During the years to Kellogg, you married the lovely Patricia Tannery, also Vinwood. I remember driving your car to your wedding reception at the Gramerton in Bronxville for you to have a getaway car after the reception. Both you and I, after marriage, settled in the Riverdale section of the Bronx, considered as moving on up in those days. After 7 years for Kellogg, you and Pat began what would be 32 years of moving around, living in multiple places in the United States and at The Hague and in Norway. You may have had the vision of that from talking to Penny's grandfather, but were you really prepared for it when you started doing it?
No, not really. You know, my mother and father lived in that building at 215th Street from their marriage, from the day they were married till the day my father died and later on when my mother left. And they had never been beyond that. And Pat and I had at least moved. You know, we moved from even getting married and moving out of the house was an experience, and we moved up to the Bronx, north up near Manhattan College, and then moved back to Inwood for a couple of years. And so we had two experiences with at least packing up and moving, which was kind of difficult. Oh, yeah, when I told my mother that I was going to take the job in Philadelphia, which was our first move, I left Kellogg to go to Philadelphia and spent 2 years in Philadelphia. Well, my mother was horrified. Not necessarily because I was going to leave her, but that was part of it. You know, she was a widow and she had my sister, but she was a widow and she depended on me for a certain amount of male things around the house and things. But she said, well, what are you going to do there? You have a good job in New York, you know. And she didn't realize, as I had been fortunate enough to realize, that the grass was greener. And that was a tremendous move for me because I started another whole learning curve in Philadelphia and learned a lot in Philadelphia and then, you know, was able to build on that. So I was not prepared to move, but it turned out to be the move to Philadelphia was the best thing we ever did.
I remember you coming up to visit your mother periodically because you were there when we had Bob Cummings' bachelor party before he got married in Houston. If you remember, we were over at the McManus in Fordham Road for a couple of drinks. So I remember you coming up here.
Yeah, well, I was only 90, whatever it was, 90 miles away. So it wasn't, was a minor
Barbara's,
move.
My wife, Barbara's from Philadelphia, and I spent a bunch of time there. When did you move back to Inwood? I'd forgotten that.
We lived up in Netherland Gardens for possibly only 2 or 3 years, I guess, and then we moved back to Park Terrace. We lived in You know that Park Terrace Apartments complex, there's perhaps four apartment buildings around a kind of a courtyard facility.
The gardens.
And the gardens,
yeah.
Right. Well, we were at the end, on the Bakerfield end of it, whatever that cross street was.
Okay.
It was a little short cross street. And we were near there. And, yes, we moved in there. And maybe that's what prepared me for moving. We had a very long couch in our first apartment up in Netherland Gardens. And when the movers arrived at the gardens, they couldn't get it in the building. It wouldn't fit in the elevator, and because they had a very small fire stairs, a very secure, you know, concrete-lined fire stairs in the building, they couldn't turn it up the stairs either. So here we are, you know, two kids from Inwood, and we had to hire a piano mover to come, take a window out in the apartment, put a pulley and hoist system up on the roof, and pull the couch up and bring it in the window. And then it had to go back out the same way a couple of years later. So we kind of really got into it the first time we moved. But we were very fortunate. After the move to Philadelphia, all of my moves until this last one, just this year, were all corporate moves. And that is the way to go.
Your geographical jumping around really came in your third and really final job with Mobil and successive ExxonMobil. Tell us about some of the position and location.
Well, I started in New York, and we didn't actually have to move for that. We stayed in the building. We didn't live in Philadelphia. We lived in South Jersey, and then I took a bus and worked in Philadelphia. So when I say Philadelphia, that was me, not the family. We were about, I don't know, 30 miles north of Philadelphia in New Jersey, in actually a town called Willingboro, which is the home of Carl Lewis.
Okay,
Carl Lewis, he went to the high school in that town much after we had left. So when I took the job with Mobil, one of the attractions of the job with Mobil was that they were planning to leave New York City, the engineering department that I went to, leave New York City in about 6 months and move to Pennington, New Jersey, which is a suburb of Princeton. And that was very attractive. So we actually never moved. We stayed in that house. We ultimately bought a house in that town, but we rented a house for the first year that I was in Philadelphia, and then we bought a house at the end of that year in the same town. So I was with Mobil in Pennington, or first in New York City, commuting into New York City, which was not too bad. It was a long bus ride, but, you know, you could just sleep through it, I guess. And then they moved down to Pennington, and then I just had a drive, which I did with a carpool, which was actually a lot of fun. Four guys in a carpool every day, and, you know, we shared stories or whatever, because it was two young fellows, myself and another fellow my age, and then two old guys. And they had been at Mobil forever, and they knew where all the bodies were buried, and there was a lot of old Mobil stories that they could tell. One of the reasons I took the position with Mobil was because they were going to move back down to New Jersey. We could stay where we were. And then 2 years later, they sent me to Holland, and that was another fascinating experience, both for me, because it was, first of all, it was my first chance to be, quote, out of the office, even though we were working in an office in Holland, but regularly I traveled up to the construction site in Germany and got to walk around in the sand and watch, you know, all the things that were being built, which is very interesting about engineering, because there's a huge difference between putting pencil to paper and watching steel go in the ground. You know, the fruition, if you will, of your plans or what you're associated with. So, I, you know, was there for 18 months. And as I was saying before, it was just fascinating for the children, because the children got to see a world that was so different and so much bigger than what they had ever been exposed to, you know, living in basically for them in a small town in New Jersey. They were too small when we were in Inwood to appreciate much. But what they had started school in New Jersey, so they had seen some of that. And they got to understand world currencies and, you know, a lot of things that many Americans have no
need to understand or any understanding of. So, and then we came back from there to Texas. So, and I went to a different part of Mobile. The project in Holland had been to build a conventional oil refinery in Germany. And when I went to Texas, I was with the part of the company that works upstream, as they call it, which is developing oil and gas projects right in the ground and then getting them out of the ground and turning it into a marketable product. So, and that's where I spent 2 years in Dallas doing that. And then with that, I went to Norway to work on an actual project in Norway that we were building. And we were building some of the biggest oil projects ever attempted in the world. We were building these gigantic concrete platforms that were then floated out and installed in the North Sea. So, and I was responsible for all of the budget and money management and so forth for all of those projects, because by this time then I had gotten completely into the money side of engineering.
And were you able, while at The Hague and in Norway, to see the U.S. through the eyes of the locals, or were you involved mainly with Americans?
We were involved mainly with Americans because the kids went to an American school, and in both cases we went to an international English-speaking church, but they went to an American school. In Holland, it was very interesting because even though it was in the early 70s, many of the people, particularly the landlord of our house, and I'll get into that in a minute, had memories of the war, or certainly their parents did. And Americans were numero uno. We were the favorite people in town in Holland. There was, you know, there was a love of Americans because they felt that we had pulled their bacon out of the fire. The gentleman that we rented our house from when we first rented a house there, interviewed us. He brought us to his apartment, and he was an elderly gentleman. He was also an engineer. He had worked for Shell in the Far East. And he interviewed us, and he was quite blunt about it. He said, "I brought you here to see you because I want to know that you're not German."
Really? Wow.
Yeah, yeah. The Dutch people still had a lot of animosity to the world, you know, to the remains of World War II. So any of the Dutch people that we had any association with, whether they were neighbors or whatever, were terrific. We visited people's houses there, and we occasionally would have dinner with someone, or they would come to our house or whatever. So, and that was maybe a half a dozen people. That doesn't mean that there weren't many Dutch people who were friendly. It's just we just didn't have the occasion. We had probably as many casual Dutch neighbors as we would have had in an American neighborhood when we spent most of our time going to the kids' sports events. That's one of the things about small towns in the U.S. today. Parents spend much of their lives running around with their children to organized events, which our parents didn't have to do because we just ran out the door and went to Inwood Park and took care of ourselves.
Right.
And I think it was a better world. The so-called helicopter parents today who are feel it's necessary, and in many cases, maybe some cases it is necessary because of crime rates and outside influences like drugs on the street corners near the schools, have to stay closer to their children's activities than our parents did. And that's probably a tragedy.
And there were probably people exposing themselves, and there were probably pedophiles, but we never knew about it. They never made the paper. People weren't worried about that. And in many cases, maybe your parents weren't around, but maybe someone was walking up the hill from Murray's, and they saw you doing something wrong, and they immediately told your mother. So there was a lot of people out there that had eyes on us a lot until we got older, you know, and we were smart enough to go up in the woods.
You just hit the nail on the head, okay? You didn't need nearly as many policemen in our day because the mothers in our day had a different attitude than mothers today. Our mothers didn't tolerate our disobedience outside the home. Today, I'm not so sure that goes along. I've had several experiences with friends or other people who have had situations in school where a teacher tries to impose some discipline, and I'm not talking about corporal punishment, some discipline or, you know, language that might indicate that the child was not being perfect, and the next thing you know, the parent is in there threatening to sue, you know.
Oh, yeah. In our neighborhood, the worst thing that could happen was if the cop told you he was going to take you home, you'd rather he smack you with the club than brought you home to your parents. And no matter if the nun or the brother was right or wrong, they were right and you were wrong, period. That was the end of it.
That's right. And that's not the way parents are acting in today's world. Today it's just the opposite. My child can do no wrong.
Yeah.
And that's I think, not making things better all around.
I know.
Where were we? We got a little bit off track there.
Yeah, one more out of track because you mentioned about moving. I know that both your mother and your mother-in-law outlived their husbands by many years, and your mother-in-law lived with you for many years. How did your family, including her, deal with the often disruption of moving?
Well, as I said, once we moved to Philadelphia and my mother realized that she could survive us being 90 miles away, because she came down on the bus all the time. And while Pat's father was still alive, he drove them down and they came down quite often. But, yeah, and my mother came down on the bus all the time. And later on when we lived in Pennsylvania, she came down on the bus to Pennsylvania to us all the time as well. So once we got through the first move, it was kind of easy. In fact, when we lived in ultimately in Norway, they both came to visit us together. And that was, can you imagine, these two little ladies who'd hardly ever been out of Inwood get on a plane and go to Scandinavia. they approached it with mild trepidation and great enthusiasm, and they used to tell stories about it. It was the adventure of their lives. So, you know, eventually the idea of our moving became somewhat of a focal point of family conversation and whatever, you know, because they grew to really enjoy, and my mother particularly understood that it had been a terrific thing for my career. Once she realized that, then I think that smoothed a lot of ways as well. But, yeah, my sister and her husband came to visit us, and Pat's sister came to visit us. And so our travel became a family travel that would never have happened otherwise.
In your two stints in Dallas, Texas, you reunited with some old mutual friends of ours, the Conyers. What was that like?
Great fun. In fact, we visited them in Arkansas a couple of years ago. That was fun. I mean, Paul and Ellen is just fantastic, and Paul is one of the most amazing people, you know, with his ability with magic and gift of the gab and to just spontaneously do and say things that are just unbelievable. We really enjoy them. They were, I think Pat says they were our first double date. You know, we used to play bridge with them in Inwood. So
I remember
had a close association with them.
I remember that you and I were the only guests really at their New Year's party on Park Terrace. Their first year married, and you and Pat and I were there then.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember that.
You and Pat, if the raising of your children wound up as caregivers for both of your mothers, Barbara and I had that with my mother than with her parents, but it was relatively short term while your care was long. How'd you handle that? What did you learn about yourselves in the process?
Well, my mother, we weren't caregiver for my mother. My mother lived alone until 1995, and I know the date because that was at my 25th anniversary with Mobil. The company gave me a luncheon, and my mother was invited, and she gave a little talk, somewhat of a little bit of a roast and somewhat of I love my successful son. And that was in Pennsylvania. And she went from there to my sister, because my mother used to spend Mothers with my sister in McLean, Virginia, because my sister's whole house was air-conditioned, and it was a great place for my mother to be. And while she was there, she had a fall, and subsequently later had a mild stroke and never left my sister's house.
Okay.
So and then she died, trying to think when she died, about 2000 and 2000 and 2001. I don't do well with those kinds of dates. So my sister was the caregiver for my mother. Whereas with us, it was entirely different. Molly came to live with us as a vibrant woman. I don't know how old she was because I'm not allowed to know how old ladies are. But she was a vibrant woman. I mean, literally, she owned the laundry room in our house, okay? You know, if laundry was to be done, you gave it to her, and she did it, and did it to her standard and perfectly. And she was entirely, every bit, day in and day out, a part of our household. She was the kid's confidant and so forth. And it wasn't until very late, you know, in her years, maybe just the last, I'm going to say 2 or 3 years before she passed away. She was also 97, as my mother was. And incidentally, my mother's mother was 101. So the ladies on our side, on both of our sides of the family, are phenomenally strong. But it was only to the last couple of years when she was, you know, in poorer health and later on somewhat bedridden that we were actually caregivers, you know what I mean? We, to use a word, hosted her, but she was part of the family. But at the end, Pat became very much her caregiver when she needed a little more care and, you know, and attention. But I think my kids to this day would tell you it was probably the best thing that happened to them. Because, you know, sometimes it gave them another voice. They could go talk. Sometimes they would go talk to Molly when they wouldn't talk to us. You know.
And you retired now over 10 years. What has that been like for you?
Well, it's been great. I had initially intended to go back and do some consulting, and I was all set to go down to Houston and do some consulting, which I wasn't terribly enthusiastic about it because they wanted me to be down there for an extended period of time, and I didn't want to do that. And then I wound up hurting my knee and having to have some cartilage surgery done and right at the same time. And I said, well, I can't go down and go work in Houston right now, so I guess I will go. I never did. But it was amazing how much there was to do to keep busy, even though I was supposedly retired. We had not a very large piece of property, but it took constant attention, mowing the lawn constantly and taking care of the lawn. We were fortunate enough, we lived on a little lake, and we had a boat, and we could go out in the boat every day, and I could go fishing whenever I wanted, and the community had a golf course. So it was great. And we've, you know, moved away from that because we're downsizing, and where we're going to live, we won't have any of those amenities, but we're also not quite able to take care of them so well, to take advantage of them.
I was going to ask you that about your relocation. You mentioned to me before that your Virginia home gave you access to a long-term injuminy. It was fishing. I remember you and Dan Sheehan making your own sinkers about 60 years ago. Would you still have access?
Yeah, where we're going to live, there's a small lake, so I'll be able to go do some kind of fishing. I have no idea what it is. The fishing in the lake that in Virginia was phenomenal. It was one of the best fishing lakes in Virginia. And I could catch beautiful largemouth bass right off my dock. But, I would still have some access. We had kind of given up playing golf. Pat had only tried to learn since we were there and never got very successful with it. And was extremely frustrated with it. And then I blew out a disc, so for 2 years I wasn't going to play golf anyway and kind of got away from it. Then golf is something that's not big on our radar anymore. So
I remember you catching perch in the bay in Inwood, and everyone went for stripers out in the where the Harlem went by. And I remember freshwater fishing up at Charlie's Hole. What other kind of fish have you been catching over the years?
Well, in Virginia, I caught pickerel and largemouth bass. I predominantly fished for largemouth bass. I used lures that were appropriate for largemouth bass. That was my favorite. And they're great. And pickerel. They were the two that I caught on a day-in and day-out basis. Other than that, Danny and I would go fishing every winter. I met Dan down there. I guess, I don't know whether we met for 3 or 4 two-week periods or so that I was down there, and we would go fishing in the St. John's River down there, and we would catch a whole variety of things. including some big sort of skates or rays that were in there. But a lot of eels. I've caught a number. You know, that was another thing that was endemic there, and you know, at the so-called island, you know, where everybody used to fish.
Right.
There were lots of eels in there. I did catch an eel down in Florida this July when we were down there. But eels are no fun to catch because they just make a mess.
I know that you, that fishing was all spin fishing. Did you ever do any trout fishing in rivers or anything like that?
No, I never got interested in fly rod fishing. I was all spinning rod and casting. At the lake, I would use a casting rod or a spinning rod, although I used a casting rod more for trolling on the boat. But, yeah, spinning has always been my freshwater avocation. And even when down with Dan, we used spinning rods for the saltwater.
I remember Dick Connors actually took a course in fly fishing, not because he was crazy about it, but he likes to learn all these things. But he went fly fishing, and I don't think he enjoyed it at all.
I took a lesson or two from a guy and was just about getting ready to start to do it. And then all the practicing with it bothered my shoulder, and then I just gave it up. It was a good excuse to give it up because I wasn't getting anywhere with it. And I loved spin fishing, so you know that was all I needed. But I tell you, people who are devotees of fly rod and fly casting just love it.
I don't know if you remember. You weren't with us. We were fishing up at Charlie's Hall, and Bob Cummings had a new spinning rod, and he put it back to cast, and he wound up putting the lure in Gene Schneider's lip, and we had to cut it off the line, and then I flagged down a cab, and I got the cab to take us down to St. Elizabeth's Hospital, and they cut it out. And Gene's biggest thing was, don't let my mother know. That was one of those
absolutely.
Deals.
Absolutely. I'll tell you, that not getting in trouble with your mother in our early and teenage years was high on the list of precautions.
You've lived in various parts of the country as well as out of the country, and you've been exposed to very different political environments. We've seen much greater polarization in our political process. The 1964 minority leader, Howard Baker, now gets as much credit for the Civil Rights Act as Lyndon Johnson. And both parties worked in concert to in expending the use of taxpayer money to fund the space program and put Neil Armstrong on the moon. I think those days are gone forever. What's your perspective on where we are going now in the American journey and where we might be going?
Well, I think that we have a problem in our political system in that it's become too important to get reelected. And our elected representatives are dedicated to keeping their voting clique happy, whatever side of the equation they're on. They want to keep them happy, and they're not worried about the other side. But some of the other side are the taxpayers in their representative district, but they get ignored. And yes, I think you're right. I think we are, at least certainly in the near-term future, in this rut of anti-bipartisanship, if you will. Nobody seems to want to be accused of giving in, you know. I don't know. People argue term limits would help. Maybe they would. Who knows?
Term limits.
For some reason, we have gotten away from wanting to work for the common good, if you will. We're only working for the good of our voters. And the other problem we have is if you've seen any of the. I'm going to call them an expose, and that's probably an overstatement, of this F-35 military, you know, aircraft program.
Yeah.
Where there's something like 45 or 46, some huge number like that, states that have some piece of the action. And I think that's another part of the problem, is that the only way that the that the politicians will agree to do something is if they can get a piece of it in their home turf. And it doesn't
I mean,
the airplane doesn't even fly, you know.
And no one wants that
plane.
That's
another issue.
The Air Force doesn't want it, but Congress won't defund it because of the jobs. And
exactly.
the other thing that people point at is the gerrymandering has made so many safe districts, both Democrats and Republicans, depending on who the governor of the state is when it's time to reapportion, that the only way for a young person to get any place, to get into politics at representative level, is if you're a Republican, you have to go to the right of the incumbent, or if you're a Democrat, you have to go to the left of the incumbent. And then that further polarizes our parties. They keep pulling further and further away from each other. It's depressing.
Yeah, and it's become so expensive. That's the other thing, is that the incumbents have so much access to money that they can they can't afford it, but their team, their organization can afford the campaign. It's become folly when you see the numbers associated with a presidential campaign. It's astounding. And what is it? Over 90% of the incumbents get reelected?
Yes, and if you go ahead.
But you know, and if you think about that, that certainly means that the electorate is not influencing government. Because that means that we just keep status quo.
And if you ask people what their opinion of Congress is at an all-time low, but they like their present guy because he brings home the bacon, you know, so.
Exactly.
So I
don't know what the answer is. I don't know. I'm more worried about the world situation right now. I think that this guy in Russia may be off his rocker and prepared to do anything crazy. I mean, I fully share the fear that some people have that when he takes the Ukraine, and he's going to take the Ukraine, that Poland or Germany may be next. And what really surprises me is that apparently, and this is from the 50,000-foot view, apparently the people that he's been telling that, you know, well, we have to have Russian for Russia, people worldwide are swallowing this, and they think that being Russian in another country means that they should take you, you know.
Well, they apparently have the ceasefire now. The other thing that I heard out of one of the things that came out of NATO, which I didn't hear anywhere else, was that NATO signed some kind of a trade or protection or some kind of deal they didn't have before with both Moravia and Georgia, which has to stick needles in into Putin. I don't know exactly what the deal is. When I heard that, I was very surprised.
I also saw just a brief flash on the computer before I got on the phone that the ceasefire has fallen apart to some extent, at least one incident anyway. And apparently it was Russians that were doing it. So,
terrific.
Yeah. You know, and then, of course, there's the Middle East, which, you know, your comment, a pox on both houses, is so valid over there, and unfortunately there are many houses that have a pox on,
The interesting thing is that in our lifetime, growing up, as I said, in this Irish Catholic Jewish neighborhood, the Catholic Church has gotten so much more open to other religions and ecumenism, and in my area I work in the food pantry at the Protestant Church. But the Catholic Church is the biggest individual supplier to it, and all of a sudden, all of the fundamentalism that we hear of is from Islam, which of course, when we were growing up, we didn't know anything about it. We used to call followers of Mohammed Mohammedans, if you remember, and it's all of a sudden as though it's the way this ISIS is behaving. The world hasn't seen that really since the Crusades. Convert or you lose your head. You know, it's just a it's it is so bizarre, if you think about it, if you consider how that we thought about that part of the world we were growing up to what's going on now. It's the barbarians are loose. They opened the gates.
And what's amazing to me is that their definition of convert now is not you Christians and Jews have to convert. It's the Sunni or the Shia have to convert to the other guy, or he's going to kill them. They have declared internal warfare within the Muslim world.
That's because this goes back to who was the rightful successor to Muhammad, which was two generations after Muhammad. There was what there was the son-in-law, or what, there was someone else, and it was, you know, and we forget that other people in the world have these long memories. We thought when the Iron Curtain came down that these people would be dancing in the streets and there'd be democracy. And all of a sudden they started shooting each other because the Croats remembered something that the Serbs did to them in 1600. It was when they were next door neighbors, and all of a sudden they started shooting each other. And we should have realized that the same thing was going to happen when we took Saddam's boot off. All of a sudden they weren't going to be dancing in the streets the way that Rumsfeld said. They were out shooting each other because they were the Sunnis and the Shiites. And we don't
learn. Look at Northern Ireland, which is in, you know, in our part of the cultural world, if you will. They go back hundreds of years with their origins.
That seems to have calmed down a bit, though. Thank God. Well,
I think fortunately the youngest generation outgrew it. I think it may have died out literally. Hopefully, it died out with that generation. That you know the generation that's now 90 years old, it's dying out with them.
I remember reading Bernadette Devlin's book, The Price of My Soul, and she maintained that the Northern Ireland problem wasn't really religious, it was economic, that the Protestants happened to have the economic power and the other guys who happened to be Catholics got left out of it. And that was really
what I had always understood was it was definitely economic, but the economic was forced by religion, that if there was a job open in the shipyard, which was a big industry there at one time, a Catholic could not have the job. So it was religious, economic, in some sense.
Yeah, it was also, of course, when the English put them down, then they brought the Scotch Presbyterians over to take the land, and then they felt that they got screwed. Then they came to the United States when it came to Scots-Irish, like your old senator was, and who wrote a book about it, as a matter of fact, the fighting Scots-Irish, or whatever he called it. So, well, we've covered a lot of bases in exploring. Your interesting life. Is there anything else you want the audience to know about Todd Roach?
No, I think that's fine. At least I know I'm still here and I'm still vocal. I haven't shut up yet. But I have a question for you, John.
Yeah.
How did you get into the second or third or fourth career of having this broadcast program?
Well, this is really not a paying career. I got into it. I write a weekly column, and I get to know a whole bunch of people through the internet. And there was a woman named Margaret Mulvihill that had a radio show, no relation to the Peggy Mulvihill that you know.
Okay.
She's an Irish woman who's come to the United States. She's a United States citizen, very involved with politics, and she asked me to be a guest on her radio show. So I got on, and I was very interested. And when I found out that I could do this from my office with an electronic studio, I said, this is terrific. I can talk to people that interest me. And because I never had the problem talking to people, as you probably remember. So I wound up with getting into it. I don't make anything from it. The people that provide it charge me, and they make money from telephone charges. But I enjoy myself, and I get to talk to people. Like I had the ex-lieutenant governor of the New York State, Val DiBella, on. I had the ex-town supervisor from the next town and the present town supervisor. I had the Catholic pastor and the Protestant rector who are close to me. I have the Marist College president and the president of Westchester Community. I had the fellow that set up the Department of Justice Computer Crime Program, Mark Rausch on. I had the whole bunch of writers, and I get to do something that I enjoy myself, and I've only had technical problems twice. Once was last week. I had to redo the show, and tonight was the dropout tonight. Now, Blog Talk Radio did put in a new feature that you could go directly in without going through Skype as I normally do, and I did that tonight, and just after me telling them how much better it was, then I got dropped. So it wasn't.
Well, I don't know where that call dropped from. It may have dropped from here, but I don't know. Although my signal on my cell phone here is quite strong, and it's been fine otherwise.
So I enjoy it, and it's I'm teaching two nights at SUNY Purchase as an adjunct. I teach regularly, and I start this Wednesday as a volunteer at Marist College, where to seniors, it's the senior program, and I have about 30 in a class. There are absolutely classes on the geology of the Hudson Valley where speakers come in, because they have 100 in the class. And I get to make up my own courses, so I've done one on what I write about, creative disruption. About how technology changes everything very often that we don't know about it. And I've done the history of computing, and I've done the history of Apple computer as a company. And I keep busy. I like to teach, and I've always been fascinated by radio. I go back to Bob Cummings and I used to stay up nights up in my house if I bought a shortwave, and would troll the AM dials and would get WCKY in Cincinnati and WOWO in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and would listen to all of these shows and would log them. And I went down to with Bill McLaughlin down to radio studios and walked around them and asked for autographs. And I was on the air. Billy and I were on the air with Benny Fields and the Blossom Seeley. And we were like props because Blossom Seeley said, and Billy and John have to be sure to eat the silver cup bread to be big and strong. It was one of those deals. But one funny story, though. You and I were always reading. I remember you reading The Great Escape, whatever it was, one of these escapes, and liking it so much. I was taken with the Western character, Bat Masterson, because he left the West. And he became a reporter on for a New York paper that's not around anymore, and also a boxing promoter. And when Bill and I were on this tour of WMGM at the time, there was a guy named Sam Taub who was known as a boxing sports guy that had the radio show, and he brought us into the studio, and we were there for the show. Marty Glickman was there, and two or three other guys. And all I remember about Sam Taub was how nice he was to us, you know. And then listening to him later, it turned out in one of the books that I read was in the last year, Sam Taub was the copy boy for Bat Masterson. So it was like all this connection all the way back, you know. So is Pat enjoying the new planning? You're going to be closer to your children now, right?
Pretty much, yes. We'll be closer to to three of them, and a minor distance further away from one. We have one in Lynchburg, Virginia, and so we'll be a little bit further away from him, and we'll be closer to everybody else. Yeah, Charlotte's, you know, even though it's still in the east, it's quite central.
Yeah, it's also, well, for a while, and it still is, it was the East Coast home of many of the movies that were done for Westerns and for other things. I had a student who was down there with IBM, and she wound up as an extra in some of the things. A very pretty girl, and it's also the East Coast banking center, and that's
Bank of America is very big here. Wells Fargo is big here. A lot of banks here. In fact, I think it was banks that were one of the leading factors in the revitalization here. But that's one of the things we've been doing here is we've been getting involved in learning some of the Charlotte history. And we went to a very interesting, the Museum of Charlotte last week, I think. And then we've seen a couple of very interesting, the PBS station down here has sort of a continuous history of Charlotte kind of venue, and they do different things. And one of them was the employment history. And this was the center of cotton mills. They managed to bring the cotton mill industry out of the Northeast and down here. And one of the ways they did it was with electrification. They got Edison down here, and he set up the first electrified mill in the country. So they could then get away from the need for streams and, you know, water power to run a mill. And Cannon, if you remember, Cannon Towels, well, Mr. Cannon started his business here. Quite a number of very, very prominent people started here. Burlington Industries started here. You know, this was quite a place here, just before, during, and after the Depression. And in fact, there was a big strike here. This is what we just saw the other day. We saw an hour program on the labor strike of 1934, where the mills all shut down as they attempted to unionize. And they formed the unions, but they couldn't get any legal support. So when the mill owners refused to hire anybody after that had joined the union, that there was nobody in government or authority to do anything about it. It was, even though it was against the law, nobody was prosecuting the law. So
The other interesting thing is that in most mergers, they'll tell you there it's the merger, but the surviving company, if we merge the Roach Incorporated, the Mullen Incorporated, they'd say it was a merger, but the new name of the company is going to be Roach and Company. Good know who was the taker. In B of A's case, they were not the taker, but they kept the Bank of America name. Now, the same thing happened with AT&T when they were taken by Southwestern Bell. The AT&T name was more prominent. The first time I remember that happening was when Chase and Chemical merged. Chemical was the taker, but they kept the Chase name because it was much better known. But everyone thinks it's the same Bank America that saved California, that saved San Francisco after the earthquake, and it's not.
Well, you know, and it's not the same Bank America that did anything, that did a lot of things. Their track record in the last 10 or 15 years hasn't been so spectacular.
My political thing I jump up and down about is after the decision saying the corporations were people, I don't think that you – and there was the big joke that I'll know that people from Texas executes one, but instead of the banks being too big to fail, they've been too big to jail. My old bank HSBC that later sold its branches to First Niagara. Well, they were convicted of money laundering, and they were openly dealing. They were laundering for drug guys and for the mafia, And they were fined $6 billion. Everyone said, boy, that's wonderful. If that was you or I, they'd be putting the handcuffs on us. There had to be somebody in that bank that knew what they were doing and approved it. And and corporations don't go to prison. You or I would be in jail. And so that's what I'm very upset.
Corporations do, but some corporations, look at Enron, you know, the guys in Enron went to jail. The banks have skated, though. You're right. As an industry, the banks have been bulletproof. They've paid the money, and it's been fines only. And that's to a certain extent, that's a problem in the environmental arena as well. The fines are trivial. Not only are the fines trivial, and then, of course, nobody gets prosecuted either. But you're right. There's a lot of things in our legal system that are crazy. I mean, you know, one of the things that's crazy is the variation in sentencing around the country or in different courts. You know, I mean, you still have hanging judges and you have wrist-slapping judges for the same crime.
Yeah. Your old governor could go away from 8 to 12. According to the guidelines.
Yeah, and you know, and that seems, you know, kind of silly because I firmly believe that every other governor in the state belongs on trial next to him. There isn't a governor in the country who hasn't done at least what he did, a couple of $100,000. That's chump change.
Well, you know? if you remember,
he didn't get a home built in Chappaqua, you know.
If you remember Spiro Agnew. Stole $5,000 when he was the governor, and you have to question his sanity for doing that. But it's the fact that now, but the environmental companies with the oil spills and that, you don't know that any one person said that we're going to do something wrong, that we're going to say the heck with the regulation, or we're going to do this. In those two cases, Exxon Valdez and in the Gulf, they said it was a mechanical problem or it was a navigation problem that they hadn't expected. In the bank case, someone had to know that they were laundering money for the mafia.
I'm sensitive to the oil spill industry because nobody makes a decision. Typically, nobody makes a decision that causes an oil spill. Whether you have a broken pipe, the BP thing, that there were decisions made there that were questionable. In fact, I think, you know, a couple of people have suffered pretty harshly for it. And many of the environmental issues, particularly air pollution issues, where companies are doing it for years and years and years and years, and, you know, and they continue to get small fines or they get a letter from the state, and nothing happens.
As in your new state, Duke Power.
Yeah, they've got a problem with these reservoirs, which apparently are completely legal. They've just passed a law that's going to make, well, I'm not sure they've passed it yet. I think it's gotten through half of the legislature that will make them mitigate some of them in some couple of years, but not do all of them, you know, and the window to do them may be quite wide, and even though they've only had one spill, but they are an accident waiting to happen. But it, you know, some of the companies that have been polluting. Well, look at the borough of Manhattan with its sewers, right? Where they finally, what, in 1995, built the first sewer in history.
Yeah.
You know, and they had 5 million people crapping into the Hudson River every day, and that's okay. You know,
yeah.
how can anybody else have any enthusiasm for prosecuting a company, you know, or making a company spend money to theoretically improve the environment and raise your price of goods when here the government itself is polluting?
A lot of that has changed, though, Todd. A lot of that has changed. The New York City has fairly tough pollution laws, now all the way down to they were one of the first places in the country to have pickup after your dog laws. I remember Chicky Dunne is saying that if that they always say they can't get the government to do this. He said, if Ed Koch could get people on Park Avenue to pick up dog shit, they can get people to do anything.
So, yeah. But what I'm saying is they're not picking up after themselves, right? You know, they built this plant that covers a portion of Manhattan, and it may well be the only one in the whole city of New York. They don't pick up after themselves. Okay, you know.
I think they are now, though. I think they
are. Well, they may be starting to. But, yeah. But, I think that storage plant that they built in Manhattan was the first of any. And I don't know what else.
It's amazing what they can do now, and you should, as an engineer, and I know when I mentioned to Dennis O'Sullivan, he thought it was a marvel. They're building seven levels under Grand Central, and Tricky's in the Sandhogs, and he said that as soon as he heard it, he says, that will never work. People won't stand for the delays and the taking out of the silt and all that. They built a tunnel up next to the tracks, and then under the Harlem River, right by 220th Street, and into a fenced-in plant or a fenced-in area in Marble Hill to the east of the central tracks and the shopping center that's there now. And they pump up all the silt, and every day trucks show up, and they take it to wherever they take it. Now, that must be an engineering marvel.
Yep, yeah.
So we are getting there, hopefully. So I hope you had a good time tonight.
I enjoyed it thoroughly, John, thoroughly. And, it was very interesting and very easy to do. Your venue was very smooth, so I enjoyed it very much.
Other than the blackout. even WINS just to go off the air, right? So,
yes.
All right, so be well in regards to Pat, and once again, thank you very much.
Thank you for the invitation.
And next week, join us with Kate Kelly, please, in the words of Met Radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Met win, and unfortunately there haven't been too many this year. Put it in the book. Tune in next week, and as I used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya.
See ya.
Whoa, Silver. Steady, Silver.